Some say the Green Revolution saved the lives of millions of people, but others say the Green Revolution ruined the lives of millions of people. And so today we pause to ask, was the Green Revolution a success or a failure?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1248th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Fremantle who are tuned into the podcast as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, the Green Revolution was, in essence, the dissemination of America's industrial agriculture to the world community. Plant scientist Norman Borlaug was the Green Revolution's principal revolutionary. Proponents of the Green Revolution claim that it enabled the world's agriculture to keep pace with the world's rapidly expanding population. Without the increased productivity of crops made possible by the Green Revolution, millions of people would have died, as was predicted in Paul Ehrlich's book, The Population Bomb. And that is how Norman Borlaug came to be known as the man who saved the lives of millions. But opponents say the Green Revolution was one of the worst tragedies in American agriculture history. They say Borlaug's Green Revolution technologies supplanted the traditional farming methods that evolved over centuries of practice. As a consequence of the Green Revolution, millions of small farmers were forced off their land and into the crowded cities. While both proponents and opponents agree that the Green Revolution Americanized the world's agriculture, they do not agree as to whether the Americanization was a good thing or a bad thing. And so today we pause to ask, was the Green Revolution a success or a failure? Who better to ask than Annalise Abbott, who is an ag journalist that one can often find in the page of Acres USA, as did I when I ran across an article called The Green Revolutionary. So welcome back to the Food Chain, Annalise.
Well, thank you, Michael. It's good to be back.
Good to be back. Green Revolutionary, Norman Borlaug's legacy, a highly controversial one. You know, I tried for years, actually, to get Norman Borlaug to join me on the Food Chain radio program, but he never would. His answer was always the same. No time for that. And away he went. So finally, I get to feature him through your work, and I'm most appreciative. What led you to focus on Norman Borlaug?
Well, it came as part of my interest in the history of organic farming in general, because pretty much the biggest argument and the strongest one emotionally against organic farming is that it can't feed the world. So you have people like Earl Butz is probably the most famous, but he's definitely not the only one who has said, you know, that organic farming, if we were to go back to organic farming, 50 million people would starve because we couldn't feed the world with organic farming. And so even when I was in college, agricultural college, everybody is talking about how to feed the world, and there's always this assumption that the only way to do that is with like new technologies we're going to develop, that organic farming wasn't even on the table as to how to feed the world. And so I wanted to look into the origins of where that idea came from to see if the ideas it was based on were really legitimate or if they were flawed. And so that was what interested me in Norman Borlaug, and then looking at him going deeper back into Malthusianism and the population debates, because I discovered they were actually all really intricately connected.
Well, were the ideas real or fake?
Well, it depends on what you call it. So, you see, there's a fact that the world population has increased. Now, that's a fact. But then the idea is becoming like, it starts way back in the 18th century with Malthus. Right at the end of the 18th century, he predicted that the human populations could increase geometrically, but he thought, with really no data to back it up, that agriculture could only increase arithmetically. Like, you would add it up like 1 plus 2, but then population would be multiplying 1 to 2 to 4 to 8 and so on. And so he thought that then population would outstrip food supply, and then a lot of people would starve, or there would be, you know, misery and poverty and all these, you know, negative things he predicted. But the facts in the 19th century did not confirm Malthus. Population did increase almost as fast as he predicted, but food production increased faster. And so it wasn't really, in America at least, nobody really took Malthus seriously until World War II era. And then they started to think about this again on a global perspective, because there were a lot of people who hypothesized that maybe the reason World War II was a problem was because the Germans and the Japanese ran out of land to grow their food, and so that was why they were trying to take over other countries, and that it was a food shortage issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was a pretty reasonable expectation, given what really did happen, and from what I've seen of World War II, especially in World War II in the Pacific, is that that is exactly what happened to Japan. It ran out of room and out of oil and out of resources. And so it had to expand. And so that's what happened to there. But Borlaug really didn't get his start there. He really got his start in Mexico. How did he get to Mexico?
All right, and so this is where it's interesting and how it all connects, because when Borlaug was in Mexico, it was actually during World War II. So these ideas were very prevalent, and I'm sure he ran into them. Now, he went to college at the University of Minnesota, and he studied forestry. So his career plan was to be a forester. That was what he wanted to do, just go out in the woods and watch for forest fires and, you know, decide what trees to harvest. That's what his job career plan was. But while he was in college, he attended a lecture by Dr. Elvin Charles Stakeman about wheat stem rust. And so wheat stem rust has been a serious disease of wheat throughout history. The problem with wheat stem rust is that it pretty much will destroy the wheat crop if you get it on your wheat. And so some varieties of wheat are more resistant than others, but when this organism reproduces sexually, then it makes new strains, which then are going to infect wheat that was previously resistant. And so Stakeman was the plant pathologist who discovered that in order for wheat stem rust to reproduce sexually, it had to have what they call an alternate host, which was a bush called the barberry. And so this had to reproduce part of its life cycle on the barberry in order to sexually reproduce. So Stakeman was one of the ones who started this eradication campaign, had people rip out every barberry bush in the country, so that then the wheat stem rust could only reproduce asexually, it couldn't make new strains, and then the plant breeders had time to breed wheat that was resistant. So Stakeman was a very famous plant pathologist, and he was also very persuasive. And so he convinced Borlaug to be interested in plant pathology. And so he decided, when his forestry job that he wanted to take didn't materialize, he decided to study plant pathology instead. And he got a master's degree under Stakeman. And then he was going to work on a PhD, but then he decided to work for DuPont instead during World War II. He was testing materials with chemicals and stuff to see if they'd survive harsh tropical conditions, things like that, in the war. And so he was working at DuPont, he was married, he had a wife, they had their first child, she was pregnant with the second one, so things were going pretty good for Norman Borlaug, until a group of scientists from the Rockefeller Foundation, they offered him a position in something they called the Mexican Agricultural Project. So the goal of this project, as they presented it to Borlaug, was that they were going to try to help the Mexican farmers grow better varieties of wheat, so that they could increase the amount of wheat that could be produced in Mexico. And so Borlaug decided to take this position. They had to do some finagling to get him out of his job at DuPont because it was critical for the war effort, but they eventually succeeded. And so then in 1944, he moved to Mexico to start on wheat breeding.
And there we are, in Mexico. And when he was in Mexico, he met some very poor farmers.
Yes, the conditions in Mexico were pretty bad at the time in the 1940s, especially for wheat. Because the problem is, you see, wheat's not native to Mexico at all. It comes from Europe and then the Middle East, but usually cooler and drier climates, so Mexico was just too hot for wheat. It didn't do well at all. The corn, the native maize, did a whole lot better, but tastes and preferences and stuff were shifting, so people wanted to eat more wheat and less maize. So you got to frame that in that perspective too, in that it wasn't necessarily a, you know, a complete food shortage. It was just that wheat was not growing well. Wheat was growing very poorly in Mexico. It was just not well adapted. The plant did not do good. Corn did well, but there wasn't that market for corn that there was for wheat. And so there were a lot of these economic factors involved in that.
And part of that, I think, was the fact that the Mexican government wanted to develop an export market, or, you know, vis-a-vis the United States, that the United States wanted wheat and Mexico is growing corn. So,
yes, most definitely.
So there you go. So Norman Borlaug is working on wheat. And what did he find wrong with the Mexican way of growing wheat?
Well, he found that, well, first of all, the wheat was just full of that stem rust that I was talking about earlier, and so they got hardly any harvest at all, and they would plant it really far apart, and it was, and the fields were, you know, in very bad shape. Like, they got hardly any wheat off them at all. And then he thought that their farming methods were antiquated because, of course, they're still using oxen to work the ground, and, you know, they didn't have tractors. They didn't have any of these modern things that were revolutionizing agriculture in the United States. So Borlaug thought, yeah, we're just going to, you know, go, if we could transplant American methods here, then this is going to help the farmers. Because he was really very humanitarian. He wanted to help people. That was what drove him. He was not driven by profits or anything like that. He just really honestly wanted to help people. And so he thought, you know, there's a problem here, and the problem is that their agriculture is bad and they're poor. And so he did a cause and effect and said, well, they're poor because their agriculture is not good. And so if we help them improve their agriculture, then, you know, they'll be able to get ahead in life and be more prosperous and maybe be like American farmers who, by the way, were not doing so good in the 1940s. But Borlaug may not have quite realized that either.
So, one of the interesting things you point out was the difference in the soil conditions in Mexico and that deep, huge, fertile loam of America's heartland from which Borlaug came. A lot of difference in natural resources there for farming, right?
Yes, definitely. Now, soil scientists will talk about the different soil types in the world. And so Iowa has, like, some of the best soils in the whole world. They're called the mollisols. They're really deep and black and rich. Now, Mexico, especially the area Borlaug was in, I'm not sure of the exact soil type, but it's probably one of the oxisols, which are these really reddish, leached tropical soils. If it's not one of those, it's an ultisol, which is not a lot better. And so these soils just don't have much inherent fertility. They don't have much organic matter. They're just nowhere near as good for growing crops as the more fertile soils like in Iowa.
So when Borlaug went to work with these Mexican farmers, he had to overcome their ancient ways of doing things. And when he showed up with a moldboard plow, a very interesting story popped out. Did it not?
Yes. So Borlaug talked to this farmer, and the farmer said, okay, you can, you know, try growing your wheat on my land. I'll let you try it. And so Borlaug, he found a tractor. I can't remember if he found a tractor somewhere or if he was still using animals, but he got a steel moldboard plow, and he goes and plows up the land just like he would have back in Iowa. And the farmer's like, no, don't do that. You're going to take all the warmth out of my soil, and it's not going to grow crops anymore. And Borlaug's like, puff, silly guy, what's he talking about? It, you know, he's just got ignorant peasant superstitions, and so he just kind of, you know, laughed at him. But then the farmer, you know, grazed some cattle because he said the cattle had to put the warmth back in the land. And so this was cited in one of the biographies I read of Norman Borlaug as an example of how ignorant the Mexicans were. But it occurred to me, looking at this from a broader soil science perspective, is maybe the farmer used a word that didn't make a lot of sense to Borlaug. But if he was talking about something like organic matter, maybe that was what was really going on, was the soils would have lost more organic matter when you plowed them with a moldboard than, you know, just mixed them less deeply with whatever kind of plow he was using. And so it made me wonder if there might have actually been some legitimate reasons for this beyond what Borlaug thought was just superstition. There may have actually been some practical significance to this.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, more of the Green Revolution with Annalise Abbott and you.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Now, Annalise, one of the things that struck me with this story of the lost warmth in the soil was that one of the great innovations in contemporary American agriculture is no-till farming. which is to say they're keeping the warmth in the soil and not turning it over with those mold board plows and exposing it to the elements and drying it out and so that it blows away. Like you, I was struck by the notion that, well, of course the Mexican farmer knew what he was doing because he was trying to keep whatever life was in that soil in that soil.
It's interesting that you bring up no-till agriculture, because what Norman Borlaug did not really pay attention to was that right at the same time as he is down here in Mexico, in the United States, there was this huge controversy going on about whether or not the mold board plow was really so good. There was this man named Edward Faulkner in Ohio, and he wrote a book called Plowman's Folly, which was published in 1943, the year before Borlaug went to Mexico. So he would have had time to read it if he had wanted to, but I'm not sure that he did. And so what Faulkner argued was that the moldboard plowing was bad because it overturned the soil, inverted it, made all the organic matter oxidize. It just buried crop residues too deep so they didn't decompose properly, and that this was, you know, part of the reason that American agriculture was in pretty bad shape in the 1930s. And so Faulkner argued that you should plow as little as possible, preferably not at all, but you had to a little bit to take care of weeds and make a seedbed for the crops. But so Faulkner maybe would have agreed with this farmer in Mexico, but Borlaug was not aware or chose to not be aware. I don't know if it was purposeful or accidental that this was going on.
And then Borlaug went to work in Mexico and developed a plant breeding system that was really quite unique and quite productive as well. So let's go through the things that he did, because pretty interesting stuff. First of all, he established a shuttle breeding program, which allowed him to develop genetics in two different places at the same time. How did that work?
Well, this was a really radical idea for his time. Like, plant breeders at the time said you have to do your breeding in the same geographic region that you want farmers to grow this plant in, because you want it to be adapted to that region. And that was the traditional wisdom. But Borlaug got tired of having to wait a whole year for each generation. He's like, well, if I go to this other part of Mexico further north up by California, I can have two generations a year and I can, you know, do this in half the time. And it was a very different climate. They're very far apart in Mexico. And so other people said, no, that can't be done. The same wheat won't grow in both. But he's like, no, I'll show him it will. And so what he accidentally did without realizing it was he bred these plants to be day length insensitive, because a lot of plants are sensitive to daylight. Like, they will start to reproduce when the sun angle is a certain length, when the days are a certain number of hours long, and that's why they're so latitude dependent. But what Borlaug did was he accidentally bred that gene out of his wheat, so it wasn't photosensitive anymore. It just did a strict number of days before it went to maturity, just based on what they call growing degree days, how many heat units it gets. And so then it wasn't dependent on the season or the time of year. So if it had a long enough time, it would just grow regardless. And so this was like a huge revolutionary step in plant breeding. This was definitely something novel and something that a lot of breeders have been done since Borlaug's time.
And so the plants that he was breeding, the plants that he was putting together, the genes, were now able to go anywhere, travel anywhere,
yes.
No problem.
Yes, and that was the key of the Green Revolution, was that it was transplantable across geographic regions. And so what Borlaug, it was really interesting how he started this. First, he started just breeding the wheat to be resistant to the stem rust. And then he wanted to breed it to have higher yields. And so he got some varieties that had really high yield when he put nitrogen fertilizer on them. But the problem was, because they had really tall stalks, like 4 or 5 feet high, the heads of wheat would get so heavy when you put that nitrogen on them that they would just fall down, which is called lodging. And that's really bad, because then you can't harvest the wheat and it's wasted. And so Borlaug's like, well, why is this plant partitioning all this energy into this, what he saw as a useless stalk? Like, what do you need to stick the wheat head 4 feet in the air? I mean, the head's the only important part of the wheat. Who needs the stalk? And so he found, after a lot of searching, a dwarf wheat from Japan. And he got, like, it was just like 10 seeds of it. It was just a few. But he managed to get those to mature. And it was really complicated, because they were like winter wheat, and this was spring wheat, one or the other, I don't remember which, but he had to get them to cross despite wanting to grow in different conditions, but he managed to. And so he was able to shrink the wheat so that the stalks were then only about like a foot and a half, 2 feet high. And if you look at a wheat field nowadays, you will see that almost all wheat, even that's grown here in the United States, is the dwarf wheat now, because you can get such bigger heads per stalk without it falling over and lodging. So that was huge what Borlaug did.
And, of course, something like that would come from Japan, correct? Because that's a place where space is at a premium, and who can afford to have 4 and 5 foot tall stems when you can have short stems that are 2 feet tall and produce twice as much? And that's why I have a yard full of dwarf fruit trees. I don't have to climb on a ladder, right? The same kind, same principle there. So he's put together genetics that can withstand stem rust, that are much more productive. How much more productive were these varieties than the standard varieties that everybody else was working with?
So if you grew them the way Borlaug told people to grow them, they were 3 times more productive. It was a huge increase. But the trick was you had to use what he called the package. So you had to use the seeds that he bred, but then you also had to use fertilizer on them, chemical fertilizers, and then you had to use irrigation so that they got enough water at the right time. So given all those factors, these Green Revolution wheats produce 3 times as much yield per acre as the traditional practices and the traditional wheats that people were growing. Now, Borlaug was very careful to make sure that people grew them the way he wanted, because if farmers just took the seeds and grew them the way they had been before, the yields were not usually that much higher. But, and then like with the dwarf wheat, they couldn't compete with weeds very well if you didn't keep the weeds down, because they were so short, the weeds would get taller. So you had to be a lot more careful about weed control with the dwarf wheat. But if you followed the production practices that Borlaug used, then they were 3 times more productive.
And that's huge. 300% increase in productivity. What impact did that have on Mexican wheat production then?
Well, it went way up, and Mexico was able to export a lot more wheat. But you see, who it benefited was, it benefited the larger farmers who could afford this. So these farmers, who, the ones that Borlaug worked with, that really did help them out. It was great. They were able to devote a lot more of their land to wheat. They were able to get much higher yields. They were able to become quite prosperous. As far as the very poor farmers, there's not as much evidence that it helped them as much, because they couldn't afford the fertilizers and the irrigation and all the other things you needed to make the Green Revolution wheat successful.
So to actually make this work, you had to use the package, as he called it, which included the seeds, the fertilizers, the irrigation. You had to have irrigation. You had to have weed control. A lot of the things that traditional farmers did not have to pay for, they managed everything with the input of time. But Borlaug's package essentially costs money. And then to make use of that package and the money that it costs to buy that, you would have to grow your farm bigger so that you could have some economies of scale. Is that a fair supposition?
Yep, that's pretty much exactly how it works.
So, okay, farms are getting bigger to take advantage of the economies of scale needed to take advantage of Borlaug's package. And those who did not have the ability to grow large, what did they do? Where did the farmers go?
They mostly ended up going to the cities, because part of this idea was that it would free up more agricultural labor, because the prevailing belief at the time, and I think to some extent today, is that development is a good thing. And what development means is that you have more industry, more factories producing more things that people can buy. But people can't buy them if they don't have any money. If they were just subsistence farmers just growing enough food for themselves to eat, they're not going to participate in this market economy. And so the only way people are going to get money is if they have a job. And so then they need to have a job at the factories, but in order for them to be able to work at the factory, they've got to be able to buy food that someone else is growing. And so what the Green Revolution did was it enabled just a few farmers to grow food for a lot more people. So then the other people, the farmers that, you know, were not as good as farmers, had to leave their land, and they ended up in the cities and working at factories, which the theory was then they would all end up being middle class like Americans and everything would be great. That's not how it actually has worked. Usually they are still really poor. Just now they're poor living in slums in the cities instead of poor living on their own land and growing food.
And given a choice, I think I'd take living on the land, but I'm not sure. I don't want to be forced with that choice. As probably many other people do not. Now, I heard over the years that a lot of the reason for the Mexican immigration and that of Central America into the United States was consequent to this change in Mexican agriculture. Have you seen anything about that?
I haven't studied it in a lot of depth, but yes, I do think it's connected because it's again, these people, they can't, you know, be subsistence farmers anymore. They just can't make a living. But then after a point, you don't need more people in the cities working in the factories. And so you have these people that, you know, really they have no work, they have no land. And so they're trying to seek a better life. That's why they come to the United States. Of course, we exploit them. That's hardly any better than where they came from. But they're just trying to find this better life that was promised to them that did not materialize the way it was supposed to.
So we hear a lot of disruptive technologies. It sounds as though the Green Revolution was really a disruptive technology.
Yes, I would definitely say it was for the traditional way of agriculture. And so we've been talking about Mexico, but where the biggest critiques of the Green Revolution have come in are not necessarily what happened in Mexico, but then after Mexico, Norman Borlaug and a group of his students that he called the Wheat Apostles, they decided to go, and they're like, this can help so much. This could, you know, feed the world. This could stop this problem of overpopulation, this Malthusian dilemma. And so India was the big place that they took these. There were other places in Asia, Pakistan, and I don't remember. There were a few other countries, but mostly India and Pakistan. Those were the two countries that it was focused the most.
Now, were these wheat-growing regions? I mean, India?
Yes, actually, parts of India, not the whole country, but the more northern parts of India have traditionally grown wheat. That's traditionally been part of their diet. The southern parts grew more rice.
Okay. So the wheat apostles show up in India and Pakistan, kind of make big changes. What happened?
Well, in some ways, they were more successful, interestingly enough, in Pakistan than in India, and I'm not sure exactly the details of why that was, but what they did was they brought this package. They said, okay, you grow these wheats, you use the fertilizer, you use the irrigation, you do all this, and then you're going to increase wheat production. And so what happened then was that it really benefited like the medium-sized farmers, the ones who were already doing a little bit better. They were able to expand. They were able to do better. Other farmers could not compete, and so they ended up going to the cities and all that, just like in Mexico.
And this is something that we see happening throughout the world then. Wherever the Green Revolution technologies take over, the small farmers have to either figure out how to get bigger or get out, just like the in the days of Earl Butz, get big or get out.
These are the same days as Earl Butz. This is the same time as Earl Butz is saying this in the United States. This is happening all over the world. So this is happening at the same time.
Wow. So it's quite an extraordinary change of development. So back to not everybody says this is a good thing. But in 1970, Norman Borlaug was awarded the Nobel Prize.
Yes, he was awarded the Nobel Prize because of his humanitarian work for helping, you know, increase world food production so much. That was, and like I said, his motives were really good. Like, he was not trying to kick people off their land. I feel like looking at Norman Borlaug, he was so passionate about what he wanted to do. Some of us may think he was a little misguided, that he should have done a little more research, you know, looked a little more at these native societies, but nobody can say that his motives were flawed because he really, honestly, just wanted to help people. And he truly believed that by increasing agriculture production, that it would better the standard of living for everyone. He honestly believed that.
And it's pretty easy to see how he would think that. Being a simple Minnesota farm boy and going to other parts of the world, you see people who are very, very poor. Well, why don't you farm right? And you'll grow a lot of food. And so he really became an apostle of the Green Revolution, as well as one of its founders, correct?
Oh, yes, definitely. He spent the whole rest of his life promoting this.
And then let's look at the other flip side of the coin, because there are people who say that this was a big mistake. And the criticism started right at the peak of the Green Revolution, you know, the year in which Borlaug received his Nobel Prize. Why the dissension?
Well, the dissension came because I think if everything would have worked out like Borlaug envisioned it, and it really would have raised the living standards of everybody, then there wouldn't have been dissension. But the problem was what actually happened was not what he thought it would be. So wheat production increased. That was a fact. So that worked, but it didn't have the beneficial social consequences that he had hoped it would. In fact, in many cases, the social effects were really negative. Like for a lot of farmers, they had been growing, especially in India, more diverse crops. They were growing more pulses and legumes, and they ate mostly a vegetarian diet. So that was very important. But then they started growing just wheat, more a monoculture of wheat. And then they had grown some leafy green vegetables in the field with their wheat that, you know, would be considered weeds, but that was an important food source for them. But the Green Revolution wheats, because they were so short, these outcompeted them, so they had to get rid of these vegetables, then became weeds, and so you had more transition to a monoculture of wheat. And so that actually hurt the diet of these rural people who couldn't afford to buy other food, because now they were growing just wheat instead of a more balanced diet that would have been a little bit healthier for them.
So instead of being true to their original job of being subsistence farming, they transitioned into commodity agriculture and were left sitting there with a bunch of wheat and nothing else to eat. And that's a tough place. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to ask what you folks think, what Annalise thinks. Was the Green Revolution a success or a big failure? This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host for this hour, with Annalise Abbott, who is an ag journalist that you can always find, or nearly always find, in Acres USA. Right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, one of the most scorching criticisms of the Green Revolution and Norman Borlaug's work came from Vandana Shiva, who wrote, well, when was it? About 1972 or something like that. And really laid it on the line and accused the Green Revolution of leaving behind diseased soils, pest-infested crops, waterlogged deserts, and indebted and discontented farmers. Diseased soils. How did the Green Revolution leave behind diseased soils, Annalise?
Well, I think what she meant in that instance was that, you see, these wheat varieties were resistant to the wheat stem rust, but sometimes, I think she may have also been talking about how the soils maybe were less fertile, less organic matter, less able to grow other crops, less able to support healthy crops. I'm not sure exactly what she meant by diseased soils, but they started to have a lot of problems with other pests and diseases. So far, the wheat stem rust has been less of an issue, although there is concern now. There's some new strain in Uganda that they're afraid if that spreads, you know, that could be devastating and destroy all the wheat. But so even though they were resistant to this one disease, being a monoculture, if some other disease comes by, then it's going to be susceptible to that, and you could still lose your wheat.
And about the pest infestants, you have
again,
one kind
you have
of crop.
Monoculture here.
Monoculture.
So whereas when you have the more diverse agriculture, pests, you know, have their favorite food source. And so if there's a diverse agriculture, lots of plants mixed together, the pests are not going to get quite as prevalent, because there's a lot of different things. But if you just have a monoculture of one thing and you have a pest that likes to eat that one thing, it's going to suddenly become much more of a problem than it was when you had a more mixed cropping system.
And interestingly enough, that increases your costs as well. When you have pests, you have to manage them. And when you have a monocrop, the way you manage them is that you buy some chemicals, correct?
Yes, and again, that's going to cost more money, and then this leads to other problems, like this will pollute the soil. It may accidentally destroy the beneficial insects that were eating the problematic insect, and so then you're dependent on those chemicals to keep your crops saleable.
And then there was the problem of waterlogged deserts.
All right, so what she's referring to there is the irrigation. So remember that irrigation was an important part of Norman Borlaug's package. And so these were kind of arid regions that they maybe did a little dry farming before that, which is where you grow crops that are fairly drought tolerant. And wheat is one of them, and you'll get a good yield, like maybe 4 years out of five, but it's not quite as reliable as if you irrigate. But when you over-irrigate these soils that were so dry, that can cause a lot of ecological problems, too. You can have salinization, which happens if the water you're using has some dissolved salts in it. And just, you know, one irrigation isn't going to be a problem, but when the water is just evaporating instead of going away into a river or something, then you're going to have buildup of salt in the soil, eventually to the point where you can't grow things. That's a major problem in irrigated agriculture.
And finally, Shiva points to the indebted and discontented farmers of India. And over the years, we've read so much about the numbers of Indian farmers who are committing suicide. What to say about that?
Yeah, I would say that's definitely part of this thing, because the reason they're committing suicide is because if they went and bought all this stuff to grow the package of wheat, they may have got more wheat, but then they are in debt. And then what happens is that when everybody adopts a new technology like this, the end result is that the price of wheat goes way down. And so you may get more bushels of wheat, but you're actually going to make less money because the price per bushel has gone down. And so a lot of times they don't make enough money to pay off those inputs, let alone have any extra to buy anything else. And so it just starts this vicious cycle. And so despite the fact that it's increased food production, it really hasn't helped the economic and the social problems. In fact, a lot of the social problems have, if anything, gotten worse.
And then Borlaug, you make note of the fact that Borlaug, when it came time to discussing the possibility of another way of doing something, Borlaug and associates were quite adamant about, no way, this is the way to do this, not that. It's almost, it was kind of like a cancel culture where when people would try to bring up perhaps biointensive agriculture as an alternative to feeding the world, there was a kind of a cancel culture. And I was kind of canceled when I came out with my book Metro Farm, because it was about farming small parcels of land close to the city. And, you know, ag economists said, you're crazy. This is heresy. You have to get big or get out. So there's really a cancel culture going on with respect to looking at other ways of doing things. Was there not?
Yes, definitely. And I say that this new Malthusianism, this concern about population growth, was the key component of that, because that was always the argument they used. They're like, well, yeah, if you have small farms, you know, that might be more diverse, might be better for the environment or whatever, but you're not going to be able to produce enough food to feed the world. And so that was always the big argument against doing things any other way. It was like, look, we tripled yields with this. You can't do that any other way. So this is the only way to feed the world. And if you have a problem with the Green Revolution, then you basically want to kill people. And so you have this really strong emotional argument that if you are against this, then you're against people.
And how do you stand up to that? And is there a way of standing up to that?
The only way to stand up to that is to dissect that argument to see if the Green Revolution was really the only way to feed the world. And so that's what some of this research has been focused on. And some scholars have decided that actually maybe it increased yields of wheat per acre, but that's not necessarily either the only way you could have increased it, or maybe there were other ways to increase food production without such a heavy emphasis on wheat. And so there are a fair number of scholars who believe that it would have been possible and still is possible to feed that many people without the Green Revolution. And so then that takes away that emotional part. So it's like, no, we're not saying that you need to kill people. We're saying that you can feed the people another way that might also be better for the environment.
What other way would that be?
Well, one of the, there has to be a lot of different ways, basically, because the problem with the Green Revolution was it was kind of a one-size-fits-all. It's like, okay, this worked in Mexico, we're going to take it to India, we're going to take it to Pakistan, we're going to take it to all these different parts of the world and just cookie cutter, cut and paste it. And it doesn't work that way because climates are different and cultures are different and the things that grow best in different places are so different. And so most people that don't agree with that approach say you have to have a lot more diverse agriculture. It has to be regionally specific. It has to be culturally specific. You have to develop a specific agriculture for each region, and you can't just generalize like, oh, this one system is going to save the world, because then you're doing the same thing Borlaug did.
In spite of having a daylight neutral varieties where you quite possibly could do something like that, it just isn't working out. Let's go back to where it all started in Mexico. It would seem like if we were going to be judgmental about the Green Revolution, we should, start with where it started, which was with the poverty of the Mexican farmers. And has there been, what is it like there now?
I'm not really sure because I didn't have a chance to really study that. But as you were talking before about the immigration, my guess is that there are some very big and prosperous farmers in Mexico, and there's a lot of really big farms, but the actual, like, small peasant farmers are still still have a lot of problems and are having to leave their land for one reason or another.
And what about wheat? It seems like when I told my wife that we're going to do a show about wheat in Mexico, she just said, no wheat in Mexico. It's corn. Does that not make sense? I mean, that you would grow corn where corn grows best and not grow wheat where corn does better.
Yeah, it does seem that, and corn has higher yields per acre too. So that's another thing where you have to look deeper at this feeding the world, because yes, in Mexico, traditionally they ate corn, and that was where corn was bred. That corn does great in Mexico. Wheat does very poorly because it comes from different climates. And so no matter how productive the wheat is in Mexico, it's still not going to match the amount of food per acre you can grow with corn. And so then that makes things more complicated, because then the wheat wasn't necessarily even for feeding the Mexicans. It was more for an export crop. It was more for kind of westernizing the taste. Like, the upper class people felt that it was better to eat wheat because that's more European, that's more high class. Corn is for the native populations, more low class. So there's a lot of socioeconomic things going on there that influenced that decision far more than the number of calories that was produced.
Well, I know that a lot of American farmers have moved their production into Mexico to take advantage of better growing conditions, climate, but mostly cheaper labor. And I suspect, as you say, a lot of those farmers operate on a scale that's much greater than the traditional Mexican farmer. And so I don't know this for a fact, but I suspect that the number of Mexican farmers over the past half century, which is the period of the Green Revolution, has diminished significantly. I also wonder about the contemporary technologies coming out of agriculture, and I think of the recombinant genetic technology, where you're taking genes from one species and plugging them into another to do more exotic things like withstand glyphosate and whatnot. How are those technologies, it seems like they're almost amplifying that Green Revolution technology. Am I right?
Well, the ironic thing about those technologies, like the herbicide resistance, is that they don't increase yields. And so they just make it easier to farm using a certain method, like using herbicides. And so the people who are promoting these, they try to use the same arguments Norman Borlaug did to promote them, but the arguments don't hold as much emotional weight because they really don't increase yields over other modern hybrids. There's really no yield benefit. The only thing it does is maybe save the farmer a little bit of labor. And so they try to promote this as being the only way to feed the world, but that argument is a lot shakier than Borlaug saying, well, this wheat is three times more productive. They can't say that about the GMOs because they're not.
So there you go. That argument really doesn't work. What about just the notion of soil science and the amplification, putting more warmth back into the soil, as that Mexican farmer alluded to. Would not that serve also to increase yields significantly? And I think especially of things like the French intensive biotechnology soils, where you just really amplify the organic processes of the soil rather than dumping chemicals on it.
Yes, there's definitely a lot of evidence out there that you can get just as high of yields by amplifying the biological processes, by increasing organic matter and all that. But the reason that a lot of conventional agriculture is starting to move that way a little bit, but there's still the biggest arguments about that are always economic, interestingly enough. They're like, oh, it takes more time, more labor, and more money, not more money necessarily, but more time and labor. So like, oh, then you have to grow cover crops and you have to think about this stuff. And it's harder than just like, oh, we just put in seeds, we just put on the fertilizer, we just turn on the irrigation. It takes a little bit more work and a lot more thinking and a lot more knowledge of the soil.
It seems to me like the principal difference between the traditional agriculture of the developing world and the modern technologies that evolved here in the United States, especially, the principal difference is that with the traditional agriculture, the principal input was time. There was the farmer out in the field, and whereas the conventional modern way of doing things is to farm with money, which is to say you buy the inputs and you spray them on. Which is best, Annalise Abbott?
Well, it depends on who you ask, because that's kind of a
I'm asking
judgment.
Annalise Abbott.
Well, asking me. All right, so that's a very American idea, the idea of substituting capital for labor. And so I would say that I don't know about my own personal view, but I think there's got to be a balance between the two at some point, and definitely just farming with capital leads to all sorts of problems, and I do think we need to get more people back on the land. As far as practical ways of how to actually do that, I'm still working on that, because there are a lot of difficulties that have to be overcome, because it's been like this for so many years.
Well, probably what we need is somebody like Norman Borlaug to come along and see the poverty and hunger for life of all of those people who are hanging around street corners in the city with the hooded sweatshirts, and some way to think, you know, we need to fix this. We need to bring some life, some warmth back into this life that we took these people off the land, and now they're stuck in the cities, and there's nothing there for them. So maybe what we need is another Norman Borlaug. What do you think about that notion?
I think it's a bigger task than even one person could do. I think we need lots of people in lots of areas developing things that work for that region.
Annalise Abbott, thank you so much for joining us on The Food Chain.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain radio show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.